Coming up on Broadway Videos, this week on Broadway, we talk with Joanna Christie and Paul Nolan from Once. We also review Little Me, Pageant, the Gallery Players production of A Little Night Music, and Sex Tips for a Straight Woman from a Gay Man. That plus some more news. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, February 9th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
You also have another book in the works. What's it's due soon? What is that?
The new book is called The Great Parade on Broadway, and it deals with the 63-64 season, where there was a lot of parade imagery before the parade passes by from Hello, Dolly, Don't Rain in My Parade from Funny Girl, A Parade in Town from Anyone Can Whistle, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in the musical Here's Love, the musical of Miracle on 34th Street. But there was such a great parade of comedies and dramas, too. It was quite a season with Barefoot in the Park and After the Fall and a play called The Deputy we don't hear much about now, but it was such a controversy in this play that there was even a book issue called The Storm Over the Deputy. I mean, how many times do plays get a book talking about the controversy that occurs because it was about Pope Pius XII and his not castigating Hitler for what was happening in Germany. So, and also, I'm sorry to say, it was the season of the assassination of John F. Kennedy and how that impacted what was going on in the country and what would happen in entertainment. Also, a lot of shows had to make some quick changes because there were many Kennedy images in shows as well. So a most interesting year, and it was also the year that Hello, Dolly was the number one album in the country and the year that Funny Girl was the number two album in the country, and we haven't had that since, where two Broadway cast albums were one and two. And that was the year of the Beatles. And speaking of the Beatles, have you been by the Ed Sullivan Theater?
No. Somebody just posted a, Stephen Dolganoff just posted a photo of himself under the marquee. They recreated, I guess, the marquee on the night that the Beatles made their first appearance, and it lists the Beatles and Georgia Brown from Oliver, and I forget who else, but it's
S.E. O'Shea, who won the Tony Award for Best Featured Actress in the Musical. It was her second appearance in 6 weeks. She had appeared on December 22nd doing her numbers from The Girl Who Came to Supper, and she was such a hit that Ed brought her back to do a medley of popular songs. So, it was Broadway's British Invasion, too, because even though this is Georgia Brown, they had the entire cast of Oliver on. Of course, she sang As Long As He Needs Me, but also they did I'd Do Anything, and you can see a young Davy Jones, who would in a few years make a monkey of himself, appearing in a rock group. And it's so nice to see that. But I was stunned. I was just going to dinner on Thursday night and walking down Broadway, and there it was. And I had to call a lot of people and say, you got to get down to the Ed Sullivan Theater. So I don't know.
Even went so far as to take down it doesn't say it at the moment. It does not say the Ed Sullivan Theater. It says something like CBS
yeah, right.
Studio. Yeah.
Well, what it is, it's some sort of plastic or canvas or whatever it is that's over the market.
Right.
It exists. I mean, so that's what it is. But I'll tell you, you know, it does look pretty authentic until you know the little ripples of the canvas and other materials make. So, but it's great fun to see it. But that's the season I'm dealing with, it was quite a season indeed.
Peter, I was going to ask you, was it Jackie Kennedy that coined the term Camelot, or was it somebody else?
Well, there's no question that Theodore H. White did an interview with her and asked her about what the president had really liked, and And she said, it's funny, all I can think of at the moment is Camelot. And that's how, it's one of the great honors, I think, in Broadway musical history, that a Broadway musical should typify a presidential administration. So, but he was quite a theater goer, really. I've run across a story that when Here's Love, again, the musical of Miracle on 34th Street, was trying out in Washington, he couldn't get tickets. He should have waited until it opened in New York. Then he could have brought cabinets, and they could have brought their cabinets and whatever. Anyway, so he said to the producer, Stuart Ostrow, I'll let you sit in my rocking chair if you give me tickets to the show. And so actually Stuart sent his wife to sit in the rocking chair. But yeah, he was quite a theater goer. I mean, and in fact, when Mr. President was trying out in Washington, they came to Washington because Mr. President, that's the name of the show.
Sure.
He only second acted. He showed up for the second act because it was a famous heavyweight championship fight that night. And you might say, well, some theater goer he is, but I think word had already filtered from Boston that the show stunk, so he felt that he should watch the fight. And so this again proves his acumen as a theater goer, that he was smart enough to miss the first act of Mr. President. So though chances are the second act was worse. You know, most musicals.
Both second acts are worse.
Yeah, they are. You know, so anyway.
So,
well, it really is incredible to think. I mean, that must be such a fascinating time to write about, because the changes that happen. I mean, it's incredible. I was reminded just recently with the anniversary that the Beatles' first appearance was only like 3 months or less than three
and less
months.
Than that. After there's no after question. Yeah, America needed something, and it needed it fast.
And look how, at that time, if you look at the top 100 or the Billboard charts, it was still not dominated by rock music. And that it's impossible to underestimate, I think, the effect the Beatles had on that, because it was such a phenomenon. I mean, I guess it would have happened anyway, but they sure were the catalyst, weren't they?
I guess, of course, it would have. But I mean, I remember even at the time thinking when I heard I was reading Variety at the time, and very interested in what was going on Broadway, of course, but needless to say, the stories about the Beatles were coming, and they were coming with a song called I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I remember thinking, that'll never go over, because me and my friends, well, we're interested in holding a lot more than hands, and it's going to be very naive. We've passed the hand holding stage with girls now. I do think that America needed something fast. Hello, Dolly has often been referred to as a success because on Broadway, we needed something fast that was light and airy and happy-go-lucky. There's that too. And that, of course, came a few weeks before the Beatles did. So it's not impossible to think that we did need take some quick steps to rally from what had happened.
One more thing on the Beatles is that, I think I may have mentioned this before, one of their earlier recordings was Till There Was You from The Music Man.
Oh. In fact, they did it on The Sullivan Show.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that. And I guess they also did other covers of other people's material early in their career, and then they really stopped that completely. Mm-hmm. But more evidence of how at that time for them to do Till There Was You was not, wasn't odd. but then, in just a few years, it was like this, it became this bifurcation or whatever, this complete, it started to be more and more a separation of pop music and rock music,
I remember when Beatlemania was trying out at the Colonial Theater in Boston. I was still living in Boston. I was just about to move to New York. And my friend Paul Roberts and I, longtime Broadway aficionados, went to the theater. And the smell of marijuana smoke was so intense. And we were like my Aunt Elaine and my Aunt Vera. I mean, we were just scandalized, at what was going on at our beloved Colonial Theater, where you'd seen Mary Martin and Robert Preston, Do I Do, and et cetera. But anyway, it didn't take long for the Beatles to become a Broadway show either.
Well,
we were in the middle of introductions.
We
get off track, but we've been hearing from Michael Poitantiere. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He's also a photographer. His work can be seen at FileSpotPhoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. So, Michael, we've already jumped in here, but welcome as well.
Yeah, thank you.
One more thing. We're going to go backwards in reverse for just a second. Peter, your book is about parades, but you can't really write about the Jason Robert Brown parade, can you now?
No, that happened much later.
Much later.
So I guess Jason wasn't even remotely on the scene in the 63-64 season.
Wasn't born. Wasn't a glitch.
That's right.
And I guess you can't write about the Jerry Herman parade because that was that
earlier.
Earlier, yeah.
Sure. I mean, obviously, as Dolly on Broadway, Parade was much earlier. Parade was, I think, 1960. So there's still plenty to write about, believe me.
Well, let's forward to today.
Mm-hmm.
It's today.
It's today, right, exactly.
With us this morning, we have two special guests. We have Paul Nolan and Joanna Christie from Once are joining us. Guys, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and saying hello. How have you been?
Thanks for having us.
I'm actually not awake yet.
Oh, well, that's, you know, very often. We had Tom Wolfhead on a few weeks ago. I'm pretty sure he wasn't awake. Was he, Michael?
wasn't he in his car at a drive-in through something?
He said he was getting coffee and going to church, and we fit us in between. So
I'm definitely still in bed.
So tell us, Joanna, I understand that you've never done a musical before. What's this experience been like for you?
Yeah, that's correct. Pretty insane. I never thought I would do a musical. I didn't think I could sing well enough, to be honest.
Really?
But Once is such a special, unique musical that, you know, the music in it is very much up my street, and it's sort of got folk acoustic roots to it, you know, the musical being by Glenn Hansard and Marquette Glover, and so just luckily it's sort of what I can sing, but the experience has been absolutely amazing, and it's just opened this world up to me. And to be able to sing and play the piano as well, they're both things that I never thought I would do professionally, and it makes it even more special, and makes it I'm just so grateful to be able to do these things that I've always had music in my life a lot, and I've always sung with my brother, who's a musician, and we've had a band since we were in our teens, but so to be able to do it on this scale is just an absolute blessing. I'm so lucky. Yeah.
And speaking of singing, I wanted to ask Paul, from a purely vocal standpoint, after doing Jesus Christ Superstar, is Once a day at the beach?
Well, I don't want to disrespect it that much, but yes, actually, it's. I thought, you know, I was obviously concerned because Glenn can really, really sing. I actually have more trouble with the low end of the show because he, you know, Glenn is actually a pretty rangy singer. He can really belter out high, and he's got quite a resonant low end. So it's the low stuff that for me, usually Tuesday nights I have a little trouble, you know, coaxing my voice back into being interested in low notes. So, but yeah, Jesus Christ Superstar was definitely so challenging that most stuff in the rock genre doesn't even come close. So, and it's so much fun to sing Glenn's music because he sings from the guts, and it's really, I just love it.
So the Superstar, that's the one that came in from Stratford, right?
Yes.
And did you do it up there?
I did.
And
yeah.
And what's that experience like up at Stratford? People say that they want to stay forever up there. It's beautiful.
Well, Stratford, I can't say enough good about it. I own a home there because I just thought this was basically, you know, a theater actor's heaven on earth. Yeah, the Stratford Festival, for one thing, as a place to work is extraordinary. And the town that it exists in, Stratford, Ontario, is gorgeous. There's you know, it's just a very picturesque town, with, you know, with kind of an old Ontario heritage kind of feel to the downtown core and the river running through the city and the actual festival theater. There's four theaters there that run reps. There's anywhere from 10 to 16 shows a year playing there and running in repertory. And but the festival theater itself is gorgeous. So sitting right on the river. So.
Well, that's it sounds like it's a thing for any theater lover to visit up there. Joanna, you've joined us from across the pond, as we sometimes we say. And you alluded to that you've always had music in your life, but your mom is she conducts a choir.
She does. She conducts the Millhouse Green Male Voice Choir, and they're wonderful. Oh my God, I love going to their concerts coming back home. There's a massive range in ages of the men in her choir, and they love her, and it's such a wonderful thing. She does tons of music, and she's been a massive inspiration. She sings in another group called the Master Singers, who I was actually just listening to. She sent me a CD over of their songs. I was listening to my mum sing this morning. And she plays piano and guitar, and so she's always surrounded my brother and I with music in our family home, and it's my brother's now a musician, and luckily I'm getting to sing now as well, so yeah thanks mum.
And so your brother is has got Luke J. Christie and the Heldra,
that's our band that sadly I've had to leave behind to come over here, but he's found an awesome replacement, and so they're still going strong, and they're still doing gigs, and it's all his original music, and he's incredibly talented. I mean, he's definitely the musically talented one of the two of us.
I wanted to ask you both I think it's fair to say the most famous song in the One Score is Falling Slowly. And didn't it win an Oscar?
It did. Yeah.
Yeah. From the film. And apparently one of the songs that's getting the most attention in the Bridges of Madison County is called Falling Into You. So I'm wondering, is this a trend?
Ooh.
Everybody's falling all over Broadway.
Right next door to us.
Oh, yeah, right.
Oh, that's right, yeah. So you could jump over there and sing along with them.
Yeah.
Some people enjoy watching the movie before they take on a role. Did you watch the movie? Did you avoid it? Did you watch the show with the other people in it? Did you avoid that? How did you handle that?
I watched it and memorized every choice Marquetta made, and was trying to get Joanna to do the same.
Well, that's honest.
No, but the movie is quite. I saw the movie on a plane from Toronto to Saskatoon in Canada on my way to do a contract in Saskatoon, and hadn't ever heard of it, and you know, was just so moved by it, and it was obviously such a heart driven project, and you know, just very unusual movie actually. The reason I watched it on the plane is the write up on it in the plane, you know, the short description was it was a modern day movie musical. So, you know, me being, you know, the music, I almost said something derogatory. being kind of a music theater geek, I thought, oh, I'll watch this. And, because my other choices were probably Jurassic Park 7, and I thought, I'm not going to watch that on a plane. I'm going to wait till I, you know, have my projection screen to watch Jurassic Park 7. So anyway, watched it and fell in love with it. And but you know, it's quite as anyone who's seen both, it's they adapted it quite differently for the stage. You know, certain characters are added, and there's just more development. So it's quite a lot different, but equally magical.
I don't suppose either of you got to see the Forbidden Broadway version of Once.
No, I...
It's quite something. Maybe they'll revive it when the show comes back. I expect they will, because your show's still running and doing mm-hmm. going strong.
Joanna, did you get a chance to answer that question about the seeing the previous incarnations at Once?
I saw it when it came out. I read about it and thought that looks exactly like my kind of film.
Uh-huh.
So I went to see it on my own at the cinema and just wept, just sitting there on my own, and I loved it. And when I heard they made it into a musical, I was very skeptical. I thought, God, how's that going to work? Have they made it? No. But then when I got the audition for it, I thought it was pretty ridiculous. I got the audition for it anyway, because I thought, well, that's not going to happen. But when I read the script, I just thought it was amazing. Ender Walsh is such a brilliant writer that I think that it's to his credit that it is the show that it is. And it's taken what was already an amazing film, but really made it into something else, actually. You know, he's embellished the characters and the story to just maximize on it, I think. And it's testament that people who love the film come and see the musical and love the musical as well. And that's quite rare, I think, for people to let go of the original and embrace the new one. So, yeah.
So did you guys come in at the same time, or did you overlap the other cast at all?
No, I've been in the show for 9 months now.
Okay.
And I was doing it with Arthur Darvill until December, and then Paul joined in December.
So have you had any family come across and see the show?
Yeah, my mum's been over twice. My brother's been over twice. They're both trying to come again. I've got a good friend in today. I've got loads of friends coming over. yeah, it's great.
And Paul, how's it been for you to go from Jesus Christ to the guy?
Yeah. I had a bit of a transition.
you had to get a haircut.
Yeah.
What similarities are there in the roles?
You've got more clothes on in this one.
What did you say?
I said you've got more clothes on in this one, haven't you?
Yeah, I do. I don't have to be in a diaper at the end.
Yeah.
I thought when you were on the roof of the thing, you were going to sing Gethsemane.
Well, I thought about it, and I decided to tell her a story instead. yeah, I suppose the only similarities are the beard and, I don't know, loss. There's a lot there, you know, there, it's funny how many characters in the theater share similar qualities, because writers write from a dramatic standpoint. So they don't write about people who are blissfully happy usually. So, that's pretty interesting. Yeah. But it's nice to be back here. The question is really kind of about being back to New York. The last time I was here working was in Superstar. So it's nice to be doing something that has a little more fun to it. Superstar is a lot of great qualities, but it's not fun. It's one of the most satisfying things I've ever done, but it isn't a good time.
Did they really whip you during that sequence at the end? Is that the problem?
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why we had to do it that way, but
I think it was a directorial choice.
Yeah, he just doesn't like me.
So you just have to find out if they're going to do something else like The Green Mile or something like that and put you in that role. So what's up next for you guys? Anything interesting? Do you have any big plans for the springtime?
Well, I'm in the show. We're both in the show till June, mm-hmm. till mid-June. So it's a bit too far off to be able to.
Well, the thing is that when I know when people are performing in Broadway shows, they get asked to do, you know, every single special event type of thing. Oh, you know, can you get just a few hours of rehearsal? Wow. Come do this benefit for us and things like that. And also you coming into, I don't know if you had the opportunity to play in the Broadway Softball League.
That is just revving up. And we have bowling on Thursday nights, which is going on at the moment.
Yeah.
But I've not been asked to do any special events. Clearly, not in demand.
Now you're going to get sucked into them. You know, they're just thinking that your card is full. So, Joanna, have you thought about doing once on the West End?
We spoke about it actually with the creators when Arthur Darvill was in the show as well, because we were both, mm-hmm. both in England. We were asked if that would be of interest, and at first I didn't think it would be, because I mean I just have loved coming to New York, and my plan is to stay here, mm-hmm. Long term, and so I was sort of in the frame of mind like, no, I don't want to go back, but actually the thought of doing it in my home, in my homeland, and doing it in the place where all my friends and family and everyone could come and see it, easier than coming over here, actually is definitely tempting. And I love London, and I don't think I will actually ever say goodbye to it fully. I just have really enjoyed making my home here, and I'd love to be able to split my time between the two. So yeah, never say never. And I love this show. I mean, I'm doing it 9 months now, and I'm not anywhere. I just don't think I could ever get bored of it, or complacent of the job, or bored of the story. I think it's a really wonderful and important story to tell. So yeah, I could do it forever, but maybe I shouldn't.
How do you feel about the piano playing in it? Were you a serious piano player beforehand, or was
No, not at all. I mean, I played since I was six, because you know my mum.
Yeah, your mum
introduced me to a young age, and it's been in my childhood. It was a massive part of growing up. Actually, I was a music scholar at school, and I did tons of concerts and competitions, and I always loved it, and I always did a lot. But then when I was 16, I played a concert at school, when I played I was playing the Beethoven Pathetique Sonata, the first movement, and it's quite quick and tricky. I just lost it. My hands seized up, my face went all tingly, and I just couldn't play it. And it terrified me, and it made me never want to play again in public. And so I didn't. From 16, I just said I love playing the piano, but I only want to play for me. And I never played again for anyone else. And so when I got the audition, I mean, I literally had a pathological fear about it. If anyone walked in the room when I was playing the piano, I would just sort of freeze and not be able to play as well. And so I just had to get over it for the audition. And I sat on the piano for 9 hours before my recall audition to learn what I had to learn, because I was determined to get over that and prove that I could do it. And now it's one of my favorite parts of the show, being able to just get to play. Yeah.
Paul, so did you have to learn about Hoovers?
funny, it was like what I needed to do was learn guitar, but I spent all my time on vacuums. Mm-hmm. And so I know the inner workings of all the models of Hoover.
Excellent.
Yeah. No, I didn't spend a lot of time looking at Hoovers, but maybe I should have. maybe I've been too obsessed about the guitar.
But you still have to get the music falling off the Hoover thing down.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a part of the show where it falls out of my pocket, and there's a bit of a sleight of hand thing on that. And I'll have to train with Steve Kazee, because I think he kind of did it. He was playing the part.
And the last thing, you talked about your guitar playing. So
We know that you've done that for a long time, but I'm reading on various internet websites that you're giving romantic advice. So is that something that people are...
What am I advising? I actually turned down a Valentine's Day interview because I don't like talking about my personal life on it. They sent a whole bunch of questionnaire things, and all I could do is make up funny answers, like really, really raunchy, terrible answers that would do nothing but get me bad press. So I turned it down. So, but yeah, what was that? I don't remember giving a Valentine's Day interview.
It wasn't a Valentine's Day. It was a romantic. They asked you how you deal with breakups. One of the interviews you did.
5 to 10 days. I get in the car and drive like a psychopath. Yeah.
All righty. Well, I thank you guys so much for joining us. It's been really wonderful to have you on a Sunday morning, and I appreciate you getting up so early. So. Thanks so much, and we'll remind everybody that you have a Twitter accounts that we'll put on the show notes and information for Once the Musical. And thanks so much for coming, all right?
Brilliant.
Thanks. Have a good day.
Thanks a lot.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
So that's great of them to join us on a Sunday morning. I got a chance to see the show this week, and it's holding up really well. Both of them are so electric and wonderful in the role. If you are a fan of Once or you haven't seen the show, I encourage you all to get out there and see it again. Shows don't always hold up. I mentioned it to Michael that I had some friends in town, and they really wanted to see Phantom. I was like, okay. And so I went to go see Phantom last week, and what in the world's going on there. I mentioned it to Michael as the only thing I could come up with is sometimes, you ever make a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy?
Sure, sure.
After a while, it's like, it's rough around. It's still the same thing, but it's so unfocused, and I don't know what's going on there. But I sort of feel like that's what's happened with Phantom, because it's just a train wreck.
What most surprised me after talking to you, James, was that, as we discussed, not too many years ago, there was a lot of publicity about how they had supposedly put in a state-of-the-art sound system, costing God knows how much money. So I expected that at least it would sound great, but didn't you say that was one of the worst things about it?
Yeah, it was terrible.
Oh.
It was just terrible. So,
to be fair, though, I have to say that when a show is a long runner, I have found that it ebbs and flows.
I might have caught a bad performance, yeah.
Or even it might be bad for the next 3 months, but that doesn't mean it can't pull itself out. So many times a new person comes in that galvanizes the company, so that could very well happen. So we'll have to hope it happens.
I read that there's a Phantom tour out that's not the Hal Prince tour, that somebody redirected it.
There's something like that going on. Yeah, I heard that too.
I don't remember all the facts off the top of my head. We'll have to get that and talk about that and figure out what's happening there. So let's move on.
I'm sorry.
It's probably just what?
Is it just another example of Andrew Lloyd Webber being weird? and thinking, oh, well, you know, it really wasn't Hal Prince.
Hal Prince was me, right? Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't call that weird. Call it self-involved.
Whatever.
Andrew Lloyd Webber's never been accused of that, has he? So, all right. So Peter got a chance to see the Encores production of Little Me with our good friend Christian Borrell, who was here a couple weeks ago. So Peter, tell us about that. Michael's going to see it this afternoon.
Tonight.
So tonight. So Peter, tell us what you thought about it.
Well, it's terrific. There's no question about that. But once again, I'm reminded that I doubt that there's ever been such a wonderfully entertaining misfire as little me. And if you've read the original Patrick Dennis novel, and I really urge you to find it, it is hilarious beyond belief. It's the story of Belle Poitrine, who grew up poor and became a movie star, much the way Vera Charles became a theater star. You know, sex and guts is what made her a star. And it's her memoir that Patrick Dennis writes, and it's mostly lies that she's very stupid. One example that she, a critic called one of her movies soporific, and she says, "This isn't that wonderful?" You know, this word that obviously is a mixture of superb and terrific. You know, well, no, you know, so she also thinks you're not paying attention because she indicates that she was born in 1900, and then the final chapter, which takes place in 1960, is called Frankly 40. You know, why kid about age? You know what I mean? I'll admit I'm 40. You've never seen so many quotation marks in your life. You know, I mean, it's one of those things where she uses expressions and puts quotation marks around them. You know, I was doing my bit. You know, that's in quotation marks for World War One. You know, that type of thing. So it really is. It could have been an amazing show about this very stupid lady, and that isn't quite what it turned out to be. And that's because Neil Simon was asked to write it. And while he's come up with a tremendously funny book, almost every line is hilarious. The fact remains that he's the one who said, you know what we should do? We should have Sid Caesar play seven roles, all the men in her life. So that pulls the focus off. And for the first time, I realized something that had never occurred to me before while listening to the fabulous, really fabulous overture of Cy Coleman Music. Not one of the songs in that overture is a Sid Caesar song. Now, I find that interesting because if you know the overtures to Gypsy, Gypsy is often called the greatest overture ever, or if you know the overture to Funny Girl, which, by the way, I consider the greatest overture ever, you'll notice that all the songs in the Gypsy overture are roses and all the songs in the Funny Girl overture are fannies. So it's very interesting to me. It could be a coincidence. I'll grant you that. All right. Given those cards on the table, the fact that it is a vehicle for the man rather than for the woman now, it's a terrific show. And Christian Bale is amazingly wonderful in playing all these seven parts. And not only that, there's a point where he has to tap dance, and he tap dances. I'll grant you that one of the jokes is he's not tap dancing as fast or as thoroughly as he seems to be because there's a sound system of tapping. But still, watch what he's doing with his feet. That guy can tap dance, believe me. And so whether he's playing the German movie director or the Shah of some long-ago country or the Noble Eggleston, the boy that Belle falls in love with, who is the quintessential overachiever, he goes to Harvard and he goes to Yale. He's majoring in medicine in one and law at the other. And you know what? A little detail I really like is that Neil Simon points out that something happens during the Harvard-Yale game, and he establishes it's November 12th. And, you know, it really could be that that's the day that Harvard plays Yale because it happens late in the season because they're the bitter rivals and they save each other for the end. And I don't think it's impossible that during that period of time, November 12th was an apt date for... Anyway, there's much more to talk about than that. So Rachel York is quite delightful as the younger Belle Poitrine, and Judy Kay, though I'm surprised still on book, she was the only one for much of the show. She's dictating her memoirs to David Garrison, who shows up, by the way, in the title number, which is usually done by just older and younger Belle. And somehow he gets involved, and that seems a little strange, but nevertheless, he acquits himself nicely in the way that he insinuates himself into the number. There has been a gay joke added that's a little strange. Watch for it. It isn't part of the original, and it would seem not to bode well for a marriage that is about to take place because anyway, watch for that if you see the show. But if you've already seen it, I guarantee you that line, which I bet you know what I'm talking about if you've seen it, was not in the original. Wonderful score in many respects and terrible lyrics in another respect. Got brilliant lyrics, no question, as lyrics go. However, they're often not right for the character because Belle is supposed to be stupid or at least ignorant. And they're awfully smart. There's one point where she sings, "No man is a true pariah deep down inside. No man is a true Uriah heap down inside." I mean, I can really appreciate that Carolyn Lee must have danced around her apartment for 20 minutes when she thought of that lyric. However, Belle doesn't know the word pariah. It's a $5 word to her. And she certainly hasn't read David Copperfield, so she doesn't know Uriah Heep. You know, so there's a lot of that. There's a lot of, there's a reference to Lochinvar. I mean, the lyrics are just much too knowing. So this is a show that works very well lyrically on a cast album when you don't know the story. But you have to tip your hat for somebody who's so literate and wonderful. And it's just while you're sitting there, you're thinking, gee, she'd never say this. And that's really too bad, because what do you do when you have somebody who's brilliant and yet not writing for the character? So but for the other characters, she does very well. And there are a few quasi hit songs here, songs that were heard at the time. I've Got Your Number, which is sung by an admirer of Belle's, Tony Yazbek, a very up and coming star, does it superbly. The Real Live Girl, which is a nice waltz, and you know, we don't associate waltzes with Cy Coleman unless they're jazz waltzes, and yet he did extraordinarily well here in coming up with a very nice swirling tender waltz. And On the Other Side of the Tracks even got a few recordings way back in the day, and that's Belle's determination to go to the other side of the tracks, that she's going to find, as she says, wealth, culture, and social position. Those are the things she must get if she's going to win the heart of Noble Eggleston. Harriet Harris plays his mother, you know, and really does act as if Belle is garbage from 7 years ago and stinks up the place. She has that unctuousness down pat. So needless to say, a really good cast of some of our favorite people, and it's wonderful to see them all on the stage together. And of course, the band is wonderful. It's full of all these wonderful instruments playing every moment of that score. So there's no question that Little Me is definitely worth seeing, and in many ways a wonderful achievement. And yet, you know, misconceived and too knowing lyrics, you do come away very much aware of that. So Little Me is a show to love despite its faults, and I certainly was glad to see it again. It's the 10th production I've seen in the last 30 odd years, so I was very glad to see it again, because this Christian Bale, I'm telling you, you know, he really rose to the occasion. So and I'm delighted to see it.
That's an interesting point, obviously, about the lyrics. I wonder, though, you know, I mean, how much of it is acceptable due to poetic license. I always point out, one of my favorite examples is, "I'm bromidic and bright as a moon."
Sure,
happy night.
Sure.
You know, Nellie Forbush would never sing that. So I guess, you know, one's tolerance for poetic license maybe enters into it somewhat.
I'll tell you, in 1984, there was a production of Little Me in England, and there was the actress made a very smart choice. And on the other side of the tracks, the lyric goes, "I'm going to sit and fan on my fat divan while the butler buttles the tea."
Right.
And what the actress did was say, "while the butler," and she looked confused, and it was like she was looking for the right verb. I mean, she didn't know what you call serving tea when you're a butler, so she
right.
like at that moment invented the word buttles, you know. And I mean, that to me was really, really smart. I'll never forget her look of confusion before she blurted out the word, you know. And that's the only time I've ever seen it done that way in these 10 productions I've seen. I thought it was a really smart choice, and it certainly ameliorated the fact that it was just too knowing, you know. So that's turning a liability into an asset, and I thought that was really skillful.
That sounds like a really good, really smart actress.
Mm-hmm. Smart director.
Sure. I haven't seen Little Me yet. I'm going tonight. I cannot wait. It's interesting. Our friend Carol Lockhart wrote to me about it, and he said he absolutely loved it, and he thought that it was the best one he had seen, because he felt he said something along the line, this is the first time you really felt that young Bell was a major character. So I guess he felt that aside from the fact of the tour de force of Christian Borle, that she really, whether through Rachel York's performance and or the direction of John Rando, that really came out. And for him, that really helped the show immensely. So I was also intrigued and very interested by the fact that Ben Bradley in his review said that he felt that in general that the tone of this production was more sweet, less raucous, less low comedy, less vulgar maybe than other productions. And I'm interested to see if I agree with that and how that affects the whole show.
To a degree, that's true. I'll tell you, one of the most successful ones I've ever seen was at Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, where Lisa Howard, who we know from Spelling Bee, played older Bell, and Josh Prince, who has since become a choreographer, played all the roles. And one of the things that the director, Aubrey Berg, did that was very smart was setting it on a sound stage in Hollywood. So out came Lisa Howard with a turban and all this kind of stuff. And you had no idea if she was genuinely a star, if she thought she was a star, if she was a faded star. And that was kind of interesting. But also he had almost like follies. He had the younger Bell almost like mouth the words that the older Bell was saying, and vice versa. And it gave a little more substance and a little more emotional pull that she became realer. I thought it was a good choice because Little Me is one of those shows that just no matter how you slice it, doesn't quite work. And I will say this too, by the way, it's awfully long. This is not John Rando's fault. But even though there have been some cuts, so there was a certain joke I really missed, the Jack Viertel cut. But nevertheless, it's long. You're going to be there 2:40. Face it. It's really one of Broadway's great puzzlements. Encores is often accused of, coming up with hit shows to do when they should be doing these obscure titles. The point is, the shows that aren't going to be revived, let's see them at Encores. And people have said, well, Little Me has already had two revivals. Yeah, the first one certainly wasn't any good. And the second one had its moments and its problems. But I guess Little Me will always have its problems, despite its million assets. It really is one of those famous the operation
problem show.
The operation was a success, but the patient died. I mean, it almost comes across as that. So, but it shouldn't be missed either. I know this sounds so contradictory.
A lot of people are saying that, Peter. I think it's so interesting. It's like they love it, but they it doesn't really really work.
Yeah. In a strange way. So anyway. But I wouldn't keep anybody away from it, and especially this airing, which is really top notch.
So should I equate it to like a car accident that you shouldn't look at, but you just
No.
You know what it's like? Oh, let's quote another Cy Colvin show, City of Angels. It's a pretty girl with the clap.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it is.
It's Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's not a bad way of putting it because assets and liabilities both, so. Mm-hmm.
It might have made an amazing movie if it had been done back then and if it had been done with the right director and the right person, because they could have condensed it maybe and made it swifter moving, and that might have helped it because I think part of the problem, as you said, is that maybe that the joke goes on just a little too long, even though the material remains top notch throughout. So that would have been, it could have been terrible too, who knows, but yes. It just occurs to me that it might've been, like with like quick cutting, like maybe if someone like, well, if someone like Richard Lester had directed it, something like that.
Well, it was sold to the movies. I still remember the full page ad. Mm-hmm. Josephine Lamine, then a very big movie producer, definitely bought the property. So then nothing happened.
All right, well, let's move forward. Michael got a chance to see the highly sought-after ticket pageant, which I understand, even if you were the President of the United States, you could not get to do it now. So at the Red Lacquer Club.
Yeah.
So, Michael, tell us about pageant.
Yeah, I would not be a bit surprised if this show transfers somewhere, because I guess word got out really quick that it's absolutely hilarious and one of the most entertaining things you're bound to see, you know, especially, you know, with the weather we've been having. I went the first night. It was the night of one of our many recent snowstorms. It was bitter cold. There was, you know, the wind, it was horrible, and it was packed, and everyone there was just,
wow,
just with, you know, screaming and laughter. So I think that says a lot for the show. I saw Brad Oscar, who plays the host, the really smarmy pageant host, Frankie Cavalier, afterwards, and he said, thank you for coming out tonight, you know. I mean, everyone was like, oh my God, this weather, but that really says a lot, because obviously that can affect your, you know, an audience's mood, I would say. But it was brilliant. This show, I forget exactly when the first production was that I saw. It's got book and lyrics by Bill Russell and Frank Kelly, music by Albert Evans, original concept by Robert Longbottom, which is an interesting credit there. Mm-hmm. And it's a spoof of a beauty pageant with men playing the women. And one of the most interesting things about this show is I don't think anyone has ever, that I'm aware of, any critic, any audience member that I know of, has ever said anything about it being misogynistic. One would think it could be interpreted that way because there are very, very broad portrayals of the women. By the way, the contestants are Miss Great Plains, played by Nick Searley, Miss Industrial Northeast, played by Frankie J. Grande, Miss Bible Belt, Douglas Lyons, Miss Texas, Alex Ringler, Miss Deep South, Marty Thomas, and Miss West Coast, Seth Tucker. Two of those guys, interestingly enough, are past winners of the Broadway Beauty Pageant, which is the male beauty pageant that's held every year to benefit the Ali Forney Center. Frankie J. Grande and Marty Thomas both have won that. So that, I thought that added an extra little frisson to this show. But anyway, I guess because it's so well written and so funny and it's not mean spirited. I don't think it's mean spirited at all. So I think that's why no one has suggested that it's misogynistic. It's just an amazing time. Beautifully, brilliantly directed by Matt Lenz, with choreography by Shea Sullivan. If it is true that you cannot get a ticket for the remaining, well, there's three more performances as of this recording, Monday the 10th, and then the 17th and the 24th. But I don't know, maybe they can add some, or maybe it will move. I would not be a bit surprised. Like Disaster, Seth Rudetsky's show, this is a show that if I had $10 million, I would produce it on Broadway. Or you know, at least at New World Stages or somewhere like that. It's so good. The original production, for whatever reason, did not run long. I was always puzzled by that. I could never quite understand it. Maybe it was the marketing. I don't know. But it's so great to see the show again. And I had high hopes for it, but I never thought it would be this good. So I hope you get to see it.
Now, Michael, were you a judge? Do they still have judges from the audience?
They did have judges in the audience, and I wasn't sure how those people were chosen, if they were decided beforehand or not. But no, I was not one of them.
Uh-huh.
So I have a press release from Bonner Brown Brown that the 24th was an additional performance added, and is, as of 4 days ago when I got the press release, is not sold out yet. So we'll have a link to it on the show page. You can go directly to pageantthemusical.com and see if there are tickets available. And it's a benefit for Broadway Cares.
And you, if the tickets are available, you can go for as little as $25.
Yeah. So next up, Peter came onto Buses and a Train and went to Brooklyn to the Gallery Players to see A Little Night Music. So, Peter, tell us, how was that?
I thought you were going to say he went to see Carnival.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, can you imagine that? Can you imagine that?
Well, you know, the Gallery Players, yes, technically is a community theater. But as time has gone on, they've really come up in the world. An occasional guest artist here, an occasional guest artist there, a director who has more impressive credits than just community theater. So it is a mixture. And I will admit that the community theater level is there in some of the smaller parts. I'm not going to say who. I don't want to embarrass anybody. But Rita Wren, her last name is R-E-H-N, played Desiree in a way that really struck my fancy, because Desiree, as we know, is not a major actress. She plays the provinces, you know, as she says to her mother, and don't ask where is it, you know, where she's currently performing. So when she is dealing with Frederick, her lover of years ago, she's a little on the pretentious side, a little insouciant, and she's acting. And that really was very impressive, because when we finally get to the send in the clown scene, she drops it all. Now she's being real. And the disparity between those two things was really, really pronounced. And I thought it was a terrific choice. And my hat was really off to her for finding not just beginning of who Desiree is, but also where Desiree would wind up. And she really made you care for her, because she really was coming down to brass tacks. And to be honest, after a whole act and a half of just being the actress, you really get the impression that she would never find who she was, that she lost who she was a long time ago, that she is one of those people who just became the performer, who became the person, not unlike the situation we have in the 1961 musical Keane, which is the thrust of the show, that he doesn't know if he's the man or the actor. Well, it almost came across that way. And so when she drops the pretense, because she really does care about Frederick and she does want a life with him, it really packed a wallop. So I thought this was a performance that was well worth the trip out there. And let me point out, by the way, for anybody who's thinking of going, I think they still have a week or two left. Please don't take the R train out there. I was supposed to go the week before. I took the R train. Well, there's construction. And you have to get off and take a bus, by the way, I think, and another train or something like that. So I wasn't going to be able to make it in time, so I had to go back home. And last week, I took the F train, which gets there in about a half hour. So and for the foreseeable future, if you're going out to the Gallery Players, by all means, take the F train. I have to say, too, what was really exciting to me was the fact, I mean, this is not a big place, maybe 150, 200 seats, and I went on a Thursday night. I really expected that I was going to have plenty of room for my coat and all that kind of business, and it was so well sold. That's what was so nice about it. They really do have an audience out there who's interested in seeing what they're doing, because you expect maybe that on a Saturday night, you know, perhaps on a Friday, but a Thursday, that's not a big going out night. And yet people went out to see A Little Night Music, and they laughed in all the right places. It was really so nice to see them appreciating the show. It really is a masterpiece. You know, I am in awe of what an achievement it is. It's such a great book that Hugh Wheeler came up with. And as somebody who was at the very, 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 very first performance ever in Boston at the Colonial Theater in 1973, to see it that night and to see what it was that night. And like in many a tryout, there were songs that had to be dropped, and it was confusing at points and unfocused and what have you. But as I've often said, of all the shows I ever saw in Boston or any other city where I saw tryouts, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and I saw plenty of tryouts in those places too, Sondheim and Prince were the smartest in making the fewest moves, the fewest changes, but always making them count the most. And that's what happened with Little Night Music. And so it was a pleasure to see this wonderful show again. So, and especially with Rita Wren at the beginning, middle, and end of her performance.
I have not been for some time for whatever reason, but I've seen several shows at Galley Players, and there are several really great ones. They did one of the best productions of Merrily We Roll.
I thoroughly agree. I saw that one too, and I certainly concur. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so interesting what you say about Desiree, Peter. Other people have made that point, and I guess, I mean, I think it's completely valid, although I was always a little confused about how, you know, big a deal Desiree is supposed to be, because when Frederick brings home the tickets, isn't his wife, isn't she very excited about, you know, does she say, oh, Desiree Armfeld, you know? So I guess I've never been completely sure how big a star she's supposed to be.
That's fair, you know, and yet all of us have performers that we like who aren't major players. So
true.
I guess it could be supported on that level. You know, I have to give credit. I wish I knew her name. I have to give credit to the woman playing Anne, too, because she did not replicate the performances on the cast album or in the movie. In fact, in A Weekend in the Country, when she opens up the invitation and sees it's from Madame Armfeld, there's that, oh, no, that we hear on the original cast album. This was, oh, no. You know, it was like, I sort of suspected that something like this could be the case. It's all coming together. I'm putting the pieces together, and I don't like what's happening. So she really did a lot of that. I mean, you can say, well, wait a minute. Now, Anne's supposed to be 18 and naive. Naive sexually, yeah, but that doesn't mean she has to be naive in other ways. And there was a little more knowingness to this Anne, and I thought that was pretty good, too.
Her name is Emily Stokes.
Oh, thank you. You know, yeah, I can't say the Carl Magnus was very good, too. He truly was excellent. And Judith Anna Roberts played Madame Armfeld. She's been around for a while. I guess most Madame Armfelds have. She was in Happy End that was broadcast on PBS some years ago. And I interviewed her once when she was out at the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey. And only afterwards did I discover that during the 60s, the Roberts comes from Pernell Roberts, who was on Bonanza, playing Adam on Bonanza. And if I had known that, I would have said, look, you were around during when he was doing Mata Hari. What do you remember? What was that like? You know, so that very famous 1967 flop that closed in Washington and didn't come in. It would have been fun to talk to her about that. But she's quite good too. And she's a pretty artist.
Carl Magnus's Rob Langetter.
Excellent. He really is good. He really is good.
It must have been nice to see. It must have been nice to see a really good production of Night Music, because that last Broadway production, despite, you know, the many good things it had going for it in terms of the performers at various points in its run, was so misconceived, I thought, so misdirected by Trevor Nunn, you know, just really amazingly so. And I do agree with Peter. It's one of Sondheim's supreme masterpieces.
Oh,
I would
yeah.
say that one, Sweeney Todd. Mm. You know, we all have our.
Like, yeah, indeed. You know.
but Company, you know, I mean, there's just, what's wrong with a little Night Music? I don't even see where you could even say, oh, well, you know, it's a little this or it's a little that or this problem with it. It's almost perfect.
Yeah. Practically perfect in every way.
I meant to ask you guys about your opinion on this before, when we were talking about Once after our chat. Is there more actors playing instruments on stage these days? You know, you have, you know, I'm thinking, this brought this up when we talked about the Sweeneys and the various John Doyle productions that where actors play the instruments on stage that wasn't necessarily part of their characters, but in plays such as Once that you have more and more people, you know, Cole House and Ragtime, the Carole King story, where there you really have, you know, some of the actors have to be really multi-talented to get up on this.
Four actors. We used to hear they had to be triple threats. Now they have to be quadruple threats.
Yes.
You know, so
I think there is definitely more of that in general, and also more of just the orchestras being on stage in various productions, because the producers want to you know, show the audience what they're paying for. And if having the orchestras on stage keeps the orchestras larger, I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say this to little me. As time has gone on, Encore seems to have more and more scenery. This has the least of any I've seen in the last few years. But yeah, I'd rather see that orchestra on stage if there's going to be enough people in that orchestra, especially, as I say, for that overture, which is really one of the great ones.
Okay, the last show we're going to talk about this morning, Michael got a chance to see Sex Tips for Straight Women from a Gay Man at the 777 Theater. 777-777. What are they calling it? What's the vernacular for that?
That's right. The Sev.
Sev.
At least it's not 666.
That's right.
This is true. 666 Fifth Avenue. Used to have an excellent restaurant called Top of the Sixes.
Sure. Remember that? Yeah.
Remember that Top of the Sixes?
I haven't thought about that in a while. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Michael, at the Sevens, what did you think about that?
Well, I don't have a lot to say about this show. It's interesting that the venue, I think it was, well, I don't know what it was originally. Back in the day, I'm pretty sure it was a porno theater.
Absolutely.
And then for briefly, I'll never forget this, it became a twin revival house where I saw such films as Man of La Mancha and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. But by that point, they had like barely, you know, done any renovation from its porno theater days, and it was still pretty sketchy. And that was called the Hollywood Twin, and it lasted maybe like, I don't know, maybe a year, I'm guessing, not much more than that. But now the bottom part of the building, I believe, is like a tourist center or one of those tour buses, things like that. But then you enter, and you can either take an elevator, which apparently I was told not to bother to wait for it, or you can walk up two or three flights to what turns out to be a beautifully renovated theater. It's 777 8th Avenue, as James mentioned. And there's this show called Sex Tapes for Straight Women from a Gay Man, which to me, you know, is less a show than a product that was probably invented for women who are going out on bachelor parties and bachelorette parties, excuse me, and want to see a show. It always amused me that there were reports that Naked Boy Singing, you know, as it kept running, that the audience started to be made up of, in large part of, you know, women, you know, single women out on just going out on, you know, on the town or in bachelorette parties, because they got to see these naked men. And of course, with that show, it was kind of amusing because it was such a gay show. It was so incredibly gay. But I think somebody said to themselves, well, let's write a show that's, you know, that has all this sex content, but it's not, you know, specifically aimed at gay men. So here we have this show. The conceit is that, let me read what it says here in the program. Sex Tips for Straight Women from a Gay Man takes place at the Midtown Manhattan Community College Meet the Authors Forum, Rendezvous with Alternative Authors of the Modern Era. And there are three performers. Jason Michael Snow plays the gay male author of this book, which is the title of the show. And then there's a woman named Robin, played by Lindsay Nicole Chambers, who is the moderator of the event. And then the hunk is this guy named Stefan, this Russian guy, or Eastern European at any rate, played by Andrew Brewer. And it started off, I thought, pretty well. Then it descended into, Peter, you probably are not going to want to go within a
no.
feet, because there is so much audience participation.
Uh-huh.
They bring people up on stage to, you know, to like do these like really kind of vulgar things and it's not, you know, but this is a quintessential example of a show that is saved by the actors rather than the playwright, who is Matt Murphy, by the way, and the director is Tim Drucker. I'm sure that he probably helped a lot too. These three actors are so funny, so charming, and so charismatic that it'll probably take you a long time to notice how really thin the material is, to say the least. I didn't, overall, I actually enjoyed a lot of it because of the actors. The friend I was with enjoyed it far less, and a friend of his who went subsequently said to see it apparently thought it was beneath contempt. That was his
term.
So it's one of those shows. It's very, very obvious what they're trying to do. You know, it's not, you know, it's not, it's just very, you know, I mean, it's so clear that the oh, and I should mention that you have to wait till the end, but the hunk guy does eventually do a striptease and a dance. So that you, if that's what you paid for, you're going to get it, but not till the end of the show, which is only, I'm happy to say, about 80 minutes long, I think.
Michael, is it a hit? Is this going to catch on?
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, because there is apparently that audience, which I mean, it really does seem like a marketing thing, you know, that was done for, you know, as a commodity, you know what I'm saying? Like not with any artistic pretensions whatsoever, but just to get that audience. And, you know, and then we can get into long discussions of, I've been going on recently about how I feel about actors doing, you know, vulgar graphic things on stage, but in this case, it's the audience doing it. So for the most part, so I guess maybe that's a whole different argument.
All right. So I guess that'll wrap it up for our reviews. Last week after we recorded, a few hours after we wrapped up, we got the sad news about Philip Seymour Hoffman passing away. I talked briefly with Michael about it, and we felt that we wanted to wait until this week for more information to come up about that, and rather than us just getting back on the radio and saying that this had happened. So anything you guys want to say? What about things that you've seen Philip on stage do? Peter?
Well, I was very surprised that he didn't win the Tony for Death of a Salesman.
Yeah.
I really thought he was a lock for that, and I think most people did, and nothing against James Corden, who was certainly very funny in One Man, Two Governors, but nevertheless, it's sort of sad when you think now we'll never have the chance to give him a Tony Award for any future performance he would have given that probably would have been very impressive. I will say that when we asked him to present at the Theatre World Awards a couple of years ago, when we gave the prize to Finn Wittrock, he was 100% behind it, couldn't wait to get there, showed up, was very pleasant backstage to everybody, and that will be my fondest memory. But little did I know that in 18 months it would all be over. Did anybody know about this? I mean, obviously friends and relatives did, but I mean, this really came out of nowhere as far as I could see. And it just goes to show, who knows what's really going on in anybody's life, and who knows what's going to happen with anybody's death under these circumstances. You just can't be sure of anything.
John Goodman was on Morning Joe on MSNBC this week talking about his new George Clooney movie. And he had a little discussion about Philip when he was John did something in the park with Philip. I forget what it was. Do you guys remember?
Mm-mm.
Well, was John also in The Seagull?
Was that what it was?
It must have been. But John had said after one performance, he says, "Hey, we're going out for some drinking. You want to come with us?" And Philip politely declined. So,
there wasn't much made of it. But around the time of, I guess, was it right before Death of a Salesman? There was some report that he had been in rehab.
Yeah.
Or was it right after?
Right after.
Right after. It's so sad. It really is. The one time I had the pleasure of interviewing him was, I think, probably the late 90s. He did a fair amount of directing with his company, The Labyrinth Theater Company. And he was directing a show called In Arabia, We'd All Be Kings, which I thought was such a wonderful title. And he, you know, you won't be surprised to hear, he was so smart and, you know, so eloquent, so just so intelligent on the phone. You know what struck me about him is that I can think of at least three examples of performances in which he was absolutely brilliant, even though arguably very miscast. And they are Willie Loman, his role in Long Day's Journey. I always forget the brothers' names, whichever brother he was, and also Capote. So that seemed to be, he was such a great actor that even though for all of those roles, he really was not right for them in one way or another, age, body type, voice, whatever. He really was just amazing and wonderful. And I'll never forget any of those performances or any of the others I saw him give. That just struck me that he was a very definite physical type. And if he had been a lesser actor, he might not have been given, not have had those opportunities, but he just, the sheer acting ability was so superb that he transcended any miscasting that he may have had in any of those roles.
I knew him socially, here and there, went back in the 90s.
Oh, wow.
Before he became a huge star, and he was a tremendously wonderful, talented person that had a very, very excellent eye for the human soul. And then I had met him a few years back, and he was exactly the same and remembered me and things like that. And certainly, I had, been in a social situation with him a handful of times. He's just one of those people that, it's a once in a lifetime thing. And it's very sad that he is gone.
Long Day's Journey, by the way, he was James Tyrone Jr. And it was, this was the production, the amazing production with Brian Dennehy, Vanessa Redgrave, and Robert Sean Leonard.
Yeah, Robert Sean Leonard.
One of him
back on Broadway.
One of the only Broadway credits that Phil Hoffman had.
Yeah. So in other news, who will be bigger, Oprah Winfrey or Audra McDonald? Or George Wolf, George C. Wolf. So the rumor is that Oprah is thinking about coming to Broadway to make a Broadway debut in Night Mother. And what do you think about that? Would that be a... Sounds good to me.
I can see both of them in those parts.
And, yeah.
I think it's one of the smartest ideas for a play ever, and it's certainly powerful in every way. So I would certainly look forward to both of these women portraying these roles. In case people aren't familiar with it is about a young woman who decided her life is not worth living and it's time to commit suicide, and she's telling her mother that she's going to do it. And by the way, here's where everything is. Don't forget to pay the bills at the first of the month. And she's instructing her mother. So, I mean, what a great idea for a play. Marcia Norman really came up with something magnificent here. And so I'm certainly looking forward to it.
I have always liked the play. It's worth noting that some people feel it's very, what's the word?
What is the word? No, you're right. I mean, this is a very controversial work, no question about it. A lot of people will not see it. And I understand that point of view. I truly do. I mean, it's certainly not a laugh riot by any means, though it's not without humor either. But sure.
Well, I guess some people might say that it's, well, obviously it's incredibly hard to watch, and some people feel like it's almost like a dirty trick on the audience to put them in that position of watching a mother desperately try to talk her daughter out of killing herself. So I guess that on the other hand, other people might argue is that what makes it a great play, and it did in fact win the Pulitzer Prize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's very effective about it, there are times in the play when the mother thinks she's succeeding.
Mm, yeah.
That, she's been able to change the subject and they're having a nice conversation, and that, all right, well, then she's over it and this isn't really going to happen. But no, this woman is very single-minded and is certainly going to make this happen.
Well, we'll have to see if this comes to fruition. I certainly hope it will. Mm-hmm. All right. So that kind of wraps it up for this week. I want to remind everybody that you can go to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com and subscribe to these broadcasts. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You can listen to us in many other ways. You can listen to us in the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and get our show automatically streamed to you when it's new. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today on this broadcast. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.